Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
It was 15 years ago that we were first introduced to Jim, Pam, Dwight, Michael, and the rest of the crew at the fictional Dunder Mifflin Paper Company's Scranton, PA branch when the mockumentary sitcom The Office premiered on NBC television. For the next 9 seasons and over 200 episodes, Americans would tune in each week to watch the ensemble cast generally reflect the experiences shared by many of us who've worked in offices. Now, to mark this anniversary, Rolling Stone's Andy Green has released his new book, The Office, The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s, and he joins me now. Andy, this book is an oral history based upon almost 90 interviews. From a writing standpoint, what type of organizational nightmare is it to combine all those individual interviews and make them flow for a book?
Oh, it took me a solid year. It was hundreds of hours. It was endless transcriptions. It was, I was up late nights for months on end. It was a lot to sort through.
We all remember things differently throughout our lives. So when you do these interviews with cast and crew and everybody involved years later, how consistent were the stories you'd hear among all the different interviewees?
We're pretty consistent, actually, but the fun comes at the moments that their stories vary. So I can tell the same story, and you hear different perspectives on it. And I think it's fun to sort of show that, to sort of show different voices that are saying different things, about the same topic.
People get off topic so much in interviews, and Lord, I know that, but when you're doing these interviews, did you have a boilerplate list of questions and outline of the book that you wanted to get through, and then did it change as people's stories would sort of get bigger?
Yeah, I think that early on, I would have them tell their stories, and I would just listen, and I'd ask a few questions. But the more I knew about the show, I could ask them about very specific things I had heard, and then they got better, because I could drill down into one argument that happened in the writer's room and then hear it out of, like, 10 perspectives. So the more I did, I think the more focused I got and the more nuanced I got in my questioning.
It seems like so many of the great sitcoms over the years are really a product of timing. Seinfeld seemed to just be for the perfect time, Friends, Cheers, all of those great shows that we remember. What was so important about the timing for The Office when it originated on American television?
I think that by 2005, that the sitcom was very, very tired. It had been 10 years of these lifeless Friends clones. It was a bunch of young, beautiful people that were living in a huge apartment that was in some big city, and it was a laugh track that was always going. It just wasn't relatable. I think people were ready for a show that took place in a universe that seemed real, that there's no laugh track, and the people are characters that are like people that you actually know at your office. It was a slice of real life at a time in which TV was just so far removed out of actual life.
And then the choice to set it in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where did that come from?
Well, because it's based off a UK show, which was in Slough, England, which is sort of a small town, but it's by London. So they are near the big city, but they aren't quite there, and they're yearning, you know, for more. And they saw Scranton as sort of by New York City, by Philadelphia, but they aren't quite there yet. So it was sort of a everyday town that it would make sense, to take place in and to put these characters in where they weren't quite happy in their lives.
And, of course, the show was filmed in Hollywood, so what steps did they take to take Hollywood scenes and make them appear as to be in Scranton?
Well, it was actually very difficult, because in the driving scenes, you see palm trees always in the background, so they had to go through digitally and take out the palm trees. But to make The Office feel Scranton-like, they would send trucks to Scranton, and they would have businesses. They would fill them up with pizza boxes and stickers and every possible Scranton thing that you can imagine. So when they read a newspaper or they got takeout, it was always actual Scranton stuff. They were obsessed in that topic of trying to make actual Scranton stuff to feel real. But they never once filmed there.
Well,
it was all in Los Angeles.
And then you mentioned the cast and looking like regular people. There was no Jennifer Aniston here that everybody fell in love with. So when the casting call went out, what was their target for who they wanted to fill these roles? I mean, regular-looking actors who are, actors nonetheless?
Yeah, I think they wanted Pam to be very attractive, but they wanted most people to look like actual office workers. I spoke to the casting director, and she wanted people who you would believe that they would work at a paper company in Scranton. And so for Hollywood, it was very refreshing that they cast people who were older, who didn't look like models, which for networks then was groundbreaking. And it was an opportunity for people like Creed, who had been on Hollywood like for decades, to find a role, actually. It was a lifeline to so many people. And they wanted unknown people, so you wouldn't be distracted by famous names.
Until I read the book, honestly, I mean, I've been a casual office watcher just in reruns. I never watched it in the first run, but I didn't realize it was a remake of a British sitcom, and you talked about that a little bit earlier, but what kind of prejudgments were made about translating a British sitcom to American TV by maybe the critics initially?
It was seen as a desperate move and as a guaranteed failure, because back in the 70s, they had Sanford and Son, they had Three's Company, and those worked as a crossover. But in the 20 years after, there were so many failures where there'd be some funny British show, it would come to America, and all of the lifeblood of it would be sucked out, and it would just be a pathetic and a hollow shell of what was really funny in the UK. So the critics, by the time The Office came, they expected a just pale retread of the UK show, which was so beloved at the time. And the pilot, it was pretty unfunny. It was a shot-for-shot remake of The British Office. So the critics just tore it to shreds.
Filming a mockumentary takes a certain bit of talent from a cinematography standpoint. So as they developed this, to shoot a sitcom as mockumentary was revolutionary. But what type of crew did they have to find that could not only shoot it that way, but to shoot it in a funny way that you knew it was a humorous show?
Yeah, in a crucial decision, they hired the camera team that had shot the first season of Survival. It's this guy Randall and this guy Matt, and they filmed The Office in the same way that they filmed Survivor. It was these small cameras on their shoulders, and they walked around, and it was filmed documentary style, which for a sitcom then on a network was groundbreaking, and it changed everything.
Of course, offices in Britain differ from offices in America, I would think, between the type of politics there. So when you pull the humor out of Britain, what type of office political humor were they looking for in American television?
Yeah, I think that they spent lots of time just thinking about what would translate. And they've got all American writers, and they sort of realized they knew race in America, it was a much bigger topic than in England, because society here is just much more diverse. So in the second episode, they did Diversity Day, which was all about race. So they really tried to make it they didn't want to just take the UK scripts and do them here. They wanted to put their own spin on it.
I'm chatting with Andy Green about his new book, The Office, The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Dutton. Andy, how close was this series to getting cut before it really ever got off the ground?
Extremely, extremely close. The first season was just 6 episodes, and with each episode, it was going down and down and down in the ratings. And NBC then was run by Jeff Zucker, and he didn't like the show. He wanted a new Friends, a new Frasier, a new Will and Grace. Just a very easy to digest sitcom that would have huge ratings. And he was not very patient. And it was on the verge of being canceled in the summer of 05. But a huge film opened that summer, which was a 40-year-old version. And that turned Steve Carell into a superstar. And that gave the show a big jolt, which kind of saved it.
Was when Carell got all that famous from the 40-year-old Virgin, was that a kind of a slap in the head of the people that, well, we wanted unknown stars, or were they okay with him becoming a known star at that point?
They were thrilled. They wanted the show to do well. And the writers saw the movie and saw Steve play a character who was pathetic, who was down on his luck, but was still lovable. And they realized that Michael Scott of the first season, he was not very lovable, and they saw Steve Carell's range. So when they went back to write season 2, they infused the character. They gave him a lot more heart. And that was a huge, huge change. If you look at Michael Scott in the first season, he's just a jerk and he's hateable. In the second season, you realize he's a desperately lonely man. And that was the game changer, because then you didn't hate the character.
These interviews that you did with the especially the cast, I think a lot of us that watch sitcoms get this idea that these cast members are friends for life, and you know they all want reunions and all that stuff, but they've all gone their separate ways. Is this just a snapshot in time for them? Was this the highlight of all their careers? How do they look back on this?
I think most of them are very fond of it and very nostalgic because they were unknown people. They were struggling. I mean, like John Krasinski, he was a waiter. You know, and so was Kay Flannery, who played Meredith. These are all people that have been looking for their break and were really struggling. So they're very fond of the show, but 9 seasons on a show, you make 26 a year. It's a grind, and I think by the end, they were all burned out and they were ready to do different things.
Do the writers get burned out too?
Yes, they get burned out more because it's so much pressure to write a show in basically 5 days. And they were up late nights week after week after week, month after month, and they sort of tapped their ideas by a few seasons, and they were burned out too. It's a relentless thing. I mean, the UK office was 2 seasons of 6 episodes each, so there's 12 of them. And the American office, again, it was 26 a year. It's just too much. It's the reason why the great shows of now, they do 10 a year or they do 13 a year, then they take off 18 months or something. You need time to like refresh.
The writer's strike kept the show off the air for 5 months in 07 and 08, but out of that strike came the episode The Dinner Party, and arguably the greatest episode of the series, as thought by many. How did it happen that way?
Yeah, it was written by this writing duo of Gene Stubnitsky and his friend Lee Eisenberg, and they like The Office at its most cringeworthy, and their version of Michael Scott is the most pathetic, and they wanted to write a sort of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf of The Office, where every moment of it is crackling with awkward tension and just cringe, and it's genius. It's one of the funniest episodes of a sitcom I've ever seen.
And there's a section in your book where you deal with Steve Carell's departure from the show. What was that mood like when he's filming his last day and then the party afterwards?
It was like a funeral almost, because the whole staff loved Steve Carell. He was a leader, like offset. They saw him as a father figure. They all revered him, and he was just the sweetest, nicest man. And he was leaving, and they were petrified of life without him on the show and without him as their friend every day. So there were tears, and then there's a huge farewell party, but there was an ominous sense of doom too, because they sort of knew that The Office without Michael Scott was a very dicey proposition.
And of course James Spader comes in, and well, he'd been on the show not a regular but a guest, and he takes over, tries to sort of replace the Steve Carell character. That didn't work. Why not?
It didn't work for a bunch of reasons. I think a big one is if you take out Michael Scott, he is a load-bearing character, as a writer said to me, that so much of the action was in response to him, that he was a magnet of all stories. You remove that magnet, and there's no force there that holds it together. And Spader is very talented. If you watch Boston Legal or his movies, he's a great comic actor. It's just, I'm not sure as part of a large ensemble that his humor transferred. And the character, it was never developed well. It was a very creepy character that disturbed you, but you didn't know his motivations ever. And it just wasn't funny. By the 18th, because that season was just a train wreck. And I don't blame him as much as just sort of the absence of Steve Carell, and they were just burned out on the show. It just didn't work.
Knowing what you now know about The Office and having talked to everybody, can you ever watch the show the same way again?
Why, yes. I was surprised. You know, I watched it so many times. I spent 2 years of my life just thinking about The Office, basically. But I can watch it now. I can still laugh. Is that funny? I can watch Dinner Party, which I've probably seen about 20 times. I still laugh.
All right, the book is The Office, The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s by Andy Green. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Dutton. Andy, for a lot of people that enjoyed this show, this is a great insight into all of the things that made it run, all the good and the bad, the ugly. You've got it all in here, and I thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Why, thank you. I appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.